Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There is a story for everyone here because every story matters. Welcome everyone to the Storybox. This is the place to be if you are a lover of stories, learning new and interesting things, and if you want to grow abundantly. My name is Jay Phantom, and I believe it's my purpose to help you realize your worth and become the greatest and best version of you possible. I am grateful that you're here today. Now let's journey into the Storybox together and hear more about whose story will be unboxed today. Have you struggled with an addiction of some kind, whether it's behavioral or substance related? My friends, this is going to be another great conversation for each and every one of you. I have been a huge fan of Anna Davids for quite some time. She is a lot of fun to actually speak to. And I had the pleasure and the thrill of actually getting to unbox her incredible story for you guys. And I think you might love what she has to say as well. And the kind of life that she has lived. She's got a lot of experience, a lot of wisdom, and a lot of insights into particular areas. This is a conversation that we do get vulnerable. We do talk about addiction, why we get addicted in the first place. I myself am an addict, but I'm also in recovery at the same time. Daily management strategies that I implement to keep me away from being indulged in that repetition of the addiction, which stops me from living and being my authentic self or reaching the very best possible version of myself every single day. So we do talk about that. Then we also talk about why you need to write a book. Now, I'm also someone that has written my first book. If you listen to my story on basically going against all odds and getting my first book published, then that is on the show too. Link will be in the below for you guys to listen to that one. But writing a book is not easy, but it is one of the most rewarding experiences that you can have. And my guest, Anna David, has written 8 books. One of them had become a New York Times best-selling book, which is honestly a tremendous milestone in of itself. Anna has shared the stage with the likes of Tony Robbins, who's an alumni of the show, and has spoken at 3 different TEDx events, all of which are featured on the TEDx site. So you can go and check that out. For over a decade, she's toured colleges around the country. She's spoken and educated students about alcoholism, relationships, and writing. She's written for the New York Times, Time, and LA Times, as well as many other publications without the word time in their title as well. She's appeared repeatedly on Today, Good Morning America, The Talk, and CBS Morning Show, among many others. And her book, which came out quite some time ago, she's re-releasing it actually, which was actually her first book called Party Girl, has also been optioned for a film, which is pretty cool, by the producer of Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, which is awesome. She also, in addition to all these amazing things, she runs a publishing company called Legacy Launchpad. She transforms entrepreneurial thought leaders into best-selling authors so they can attract high-quality clients, become go-to media sources, land speaking gigs, and grow into being the best leaders in their field. And Anna really is an advocate to saying why you need to write a book. It is such a rewarding experience, most and foremost, actually. Even though it is difficult, it will be a fun challenging journey at that, but the opportunities that can come from writing a book in the first place is tremendous. And this is also the second part of the conversation. We do talk about the writing process and why writing a book is important or can be important if you want to go down that road as well. So I know that this is going to be a very useful conversation for each and every one of you in some way, shape or form. I think that all of us have some form of addictive pattern in our life, to some respect, whatever that is. I can't make a complete judgment on that. But I do know that Anna is able to help each and every one of us help manage it. And hopefully my story and her story will help do just that. So please share this one around with your friends and family as well. Don't forget to leave a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts too, and subscribe before you go. All right, my friends, you know what time it is. It is time to journey with me into this story box as we listen to the incredible wisdom, the advice, and the stories of none other than Anna B. David.
So much. That was lovely. And it was so lovely that I do have to correct one thing, and people make the mistake all the time. I've written 8 books. Only one is a New York Times bestseller. And oftentimes I don't correct people because I'm like, let them think that. But the party girl, his name is Niels Juul. And it's a movie that's in development. So everything else was perfect.
Hey, you're still a New York Times bestseller. There you go.
Yeah, do it once to talk about it.
That's right. Well, it's really amazing to have you here on the show. I have been, I guess you could call me a fan from afar for quite some time. I've been watching the progression. I've been watching your videos as well with the advice on how to get a book published and what to do, what not to do, all that sort of stuff. It's been very, very helpful. The very first question that I do have for you though, before we dive further into your story, is what does success look like for you?
That is such a great question. I actually have a book called How to Get Successful by Effing Up Your Life. Mm-hmm. I think a lot about success because I come from a family that was its higher power, was success and money. And I always felt so unsuccessful, especially compared to them. They all went to Harvard and had PhDs, and I was this kind of F up. And I believe internally, I thought that making money was a sign that you were a bad person and that one had to not want that and to be some sort of a creative person. Mm-hmm. And all I wanted was my family to see me as successful, and they never did. And, mm-hmm. I remember saying to my dad, I did it. I sold my second book. And he said, well, you would have made more money as a lawyer. and then I started this company 3 years ago, and I started to make money. I started to make real money. And suddenly they see me as successful. And to me, success, it wasn't when I was a New York Times bestselling author. It wasn't when I was on the Today Show. It wasn't those things. It was my bank account. And to me, success is really, it's wonderful to have that. It really, really is. But it's also, it's being satisfied with what I've got. I spent so much of my life wanting what I didn't have. So to have these gifts and to be emotionally mature enough to appreciate them and to not be constantly looking for the bright, shiny ball somewhere else.
How did you feel when you did make the money and towards your parents saying, oh, now you're successful? How did that make you feel?
I'm not going to lie. It made me feel really gratified that they finally saw me that way. Mm. But what also happened is that I stopped seeking that validation from them. So I actually think it has less to do with the fact, well, with my dad, all he cares about is making money. But with my mom, I it was less what was happening, but that I wasn't constantly wanting it. I used to send her articles about me and never get the response I wanted. And finally, I just sort of think I did enough of spiritual and emotional work to just go, I don't care. And that's when it comes. My mom literally says to me, are you as amazing as I think you are? Or is it just because I gave birth to you? And because I have great esteem now. I'm like, no, I'm really that amazing. It's not just that I, you know, you birthed me. So it really has been a journey.
I can imagine it's been quite the journey for you. And you mentioned in that first explanation how, you know, you kept effing up quite a bit. I'm curious, what were some of the things that you would class as effing up?
Well, I have been fired from every single job I have ever had, including swirling the yogurt wrong at a frozen yogurt place when I was in college. I mean, it's really quite incredible. I mean, I think over 10 jobs. And I thought, you know, I've been sober over 21 years. And I thought when I got sober, oh, this is just because I'm, you know, out all night and, you know, all this stuff. No. It's because of me, as it turns out. I have a lot of trouble respecting people who I do not feel deserve my respect. And that's actually not the way the world works. You've got to have the humility to respect people who you may not deserve it, because it's really not up to me to decide. So there was a lot of firing. There was a lot of just not getting my shit together. And then there was a lot of cocaine. I really struggled for, I think, a longer time than most.
When did the cocaine start, or how did it start, more or less? Was it someone introducing it to you, or was it by your own merit going in and trying to source it out for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it would be wonderful to say like, oh, it was peer pressure. But if anything, I probably was the pressurer. I really didn't. I mean, I really used them on my own a lot. But, you know, I first tried it in high school and I loved it. And then I tried it in college, but it was really still on like a trying basis. And then when I was about 25 or 26, I realized that I just needed my own dealer and everything was going to be great. And when you're at that stage, it's no good. You know, it always made me feel terrible towards the end, but I didn't think there was a way to stop. And my life had really gone off the rails. I really had nobody in my life. I had no friends. I was not in touch with my family. I was sort of working because there had been this internet boom. You're too young to know about it. But when I was starting my career, I was like, well, I had been in the working world for like 5 years or so, you know, in the year 2000, suddenly there were all these websites and I had worked at some magazines where I'd been fired. So I had these writing and editing skills. So I was unemployable, but employed. And that was it.
Did all this contribute you knowing or being told or thinking that you are effing up a lot of things, I guess, trying to find your worth and identity in life? Did all that contribute to you and your identity at all? If that question makes sense?
It does. It does. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that my dad used to do, and my mom a little bit, is like they would be like, "You're a monster. You're so bad." When I was born, you know, I had colic, and so apparently I just cried and cried and cried. And I always heard about, you know, she had colic. We had to leave the house all the time because she never stopped crying. It wasn't until I was an adult that someone explained to me colic is something just a baby had. I thought I'd had it my whole childhood because that's what I always heard. And I was really emotional and my dad's, you know, very mentally ill. And so when I would cry, he would always laugh at me and then the whole family would laugh at me. And then I would really act out. And all I knew is that I acted out and they would tell me that I was a monster. And so I really behaved monstrously. I was very emotionally abusive to a lot of people. I just thought that's who I was. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until, you know, I got sober and I started to realize, okay, that's not who I am. That's who I've acted like. And I've been acting like that from a place of deep pain. And uncovering that and doing trauma work and all of these things. And now I get to go, oh, I was reacting to my circumstances. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing anything. And my boyfriend of 3 years is like, you're the least monstrous person I know. And I mean, I really thought I was crazy and horrible for a lot of my life.
Mm. What did or where did your addiction eventually lead to?
Well, it really just led to me, you know, home in my apartment with two cats and cocaine and wanting to die. And thinking that there was just no way to stop. I kept trying to stop and it didn't work. And finally, I got so desperate that I was willing to go to rehab and then 12-step. And then it turned out to be nothing like I expected it to be. And it turned out to be this joyful place where people were talking about solutions to problems I hadn't even begun to be able to articulate that I had. And it's really when my life began.
Mm. You've written a book on addiction, I believe. And I'm curious, why do you think, or what are some of the contributing factors that do attribute to someone being an addict? Because I've been an addict pretty much my entire life, or a recovering addict now, more or less. And it was more behavioral addiction, not substance abuse, or really in a way I was abusing food, and which is technically a substance, you could class it as that, but not like the mainstream alcoholism or drugs or anything of that nature. But I'm curious, if your work and looking at addiction, why is it that some people do get addicted extremely in the first place?
Yeah. Well, oh, by the way, do you have to not eat sugar and flour and that kind of thing?
Oh, I still do. I'm like, people that know me know that I'm a lot better than what I was before, but I love my cookies. I love my donuts, all that sort of stuff, but it's like a maintenance thing. Like, I won't have it all the time. So I'm careful with that now.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I mean, so I believe that addiction, you know, we have a predisposition based on genetics. Mm. And I believe it's that combined with what happens to us as between the ages of 0 and 10. And certainly there are people who have alcoholism in their family and they don't become addicts. And then there are people who don't, who do become addicts. And so I do think it's, you know, the predisposition can just be oversensitivity, being a very sensitive person who is reacting to a kind of harsh world and going, this is scary. And I need something to quell that. And part of it is reacting to unbearable circumstances. And so I don't think that people just try to sort of kill themselves with substance or do substances till it's damaging, unless they're really trying to escape pain.
Yeah.
So I believe, and I certainly didn't, you know, this is just something I've heard, is basically it's like, and I experienced at first it works and it works so well. And it's that panacea for all that discomfort and you know, often works for me for many years. So this rude awakening that it stopped working and in fact really just exacerbated those terrible feelings, it takes years to face that, because what a betrayal. And you're just like, no, it's going to feel as good as it did in the beginning. And it's when you kind of keep hitting your head against the wall, and finally you just go, I don't think it's going to go back there. Let me just see. I'm powerless over this. Let me just explore this other world. And that's all it takes.
For someone that is struggling with addiction at the moment of all kinds, what sort of advice would you want to give to them?
Just that recovery is not at all what you think it's going to be. It's just simply not. And this perception that we have before we get into it, that everybody went, you know, skipping into recovery with holding hands and singing Kumbaya because a lot of us seem so happy about it now. Most people I encounter wanted to die. And they only had that. The only reason this worked is that we were so desperate that we had no other options. And it was only when you get to that place that you can start to see what sort of shadow you've been living in. And then you can start to really live your life. And it's, I promise, it's nothing like you expect it to be. And it doesn't mean it's perfect by any means, but it's a lot better. I don't know anyone who found recovery in their life got a lot worse.
Yeah, I don't either, to be honest. I mean, it's a daily process for me now because I don't want to, there's triggers all around and I want to try and minimize those triggers as much as possible. But I also want to live my life to the fullest at the same time. And if I want to have a cookie, if I want to have a donut, if I want to have a bar of chocolate, all that sort of stuff, it doesn't mean that I'm going to become another addict again. It just means that I can now enjoy that cookie or that chocolate in that time period and then not go every single day having a bar of chocolate and then just, you know, going into that same rabbit hole again. So, I mean, it is possible. I mean, it became possible for me and it was difficult, but it's a journey, isn't it? Like it's a consistent journey. And I'm curious, what are some of the things that you do today that keep you away from going down that same, I guess, rabbit hole of becoming an addict again?
I mean, I do believe I'm an addict. I'm just in recovery. You know, it's not really, because it's in my brain. It's how I'm wired. And whether I was born that way or whether I was half born that way and what happened to me, you know, solidified the wiring, I don't know. But I'm different. I'm different than my boyfriend. I'm different than my fellows who are not addicts. My brain works differently. I'm more self-obsessed. I'm more insecure. And I'm more aware of those things. I prioritize my feelings. I think my feelings mean everything when really they're just, it's like wind, you know, it really doesn't matter. And so I do a lot and it's, so, you know, basically what it comes down to is I got to keep myself in a place where a drink or a drug doesn't look good to me. Now a drink or a drug doesn't look good to me in a long, long time. Cause I remember what it was like, but my tolerance for discomfort and pain is very low. And so I do these things, not cause I'm some amazing person, but I do them because I want to minimize my discomfort. So I meditate about 40 minutes a day. I pray every morning. I try to, in Zoom land, you know, log onto a meeting every day. I call a sponsor when I'm agitated. I sponsor other women. And I try to work the 12 steps. And when I do that, my God, my life is so much easier. And I have spent many years not doing that, not taking advantage of what's sitting right in front of me. But yeah, that's what I do. I try to be nice. As we were before we were recording, I was talking about how I'm not that nice. I am. I absolutely am a total love machine to a lot of people. But my instinct is not to be nice. My instinct is to think you, not you, because you're too lovely, but like you, the average you walking down the street is about to like fuck with me. And I better have my defenses up and I better, my ego better show you it doesn't matter. I'm going to get to you first. And so I really have to pause and make it not like that.
That's interesting because I am generally like not looking to fight anyone. Like it's curious to me how, especially in today's day and age, you can walk down the street and there's a couple of people kind of looking like they're miserable and like they're on guard sort of thing. And when you smile at them, they don't smile back. It's changed so much from when I was a kid. And that wasn't that long ago, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, why is it that we are like that? Is it because of the trauma? Is it because of the things that we've been through and we're just less trusting in today's day and age?
And to be clear, I don't fight. I've never.
I know.
It's very subtle. But I think, going back to the Neanderthals, you know, we're on the lookout for danger. As human beings, that is our natural instinct. There's this great book by somebody named Rick Hansen. It's called Buddha's Brain. And it's all about, you know, it's just that thing about where, you know, when we hear a twig over there, we don't think puppy dog, we think wild tiger, whatever, because that's what our ancestors thought. So we are wired towards negativity. So there's nothing wrong with that. But that's why I think anybody who has any sort of predisposition towards negativity really has to work hard to go, ah, that's just fear. That's got nothing to do with what's going on. And fear, the acronym, is false evidence appearing real.
Yeah.
So we think it, and it, you know, sometimes fear is like you're too scared to admit you're scared. So you don't even understand that that's what's happening.
Yeah.
You know,
what's your biggest fear at the moment? Do you have one?
That's a great question. My fear doesn't come up. I don't get scared of the big stuff. I rappelled down the side of the W Hotel, which is down the street from here. I, you know, jumped out of an airplane in New Zealand, by the way, and I go on live TV and I'm not scared. I'm scared of the little things, and it's relatively constant now that I'm aware of it. But the great thing is that I get to be aware of it and just go, oh, this doesn't matter. Last night, I have a friend who's like a, you know, a famous person. And she took me to this very fancy premiere last night. And, you know, it was like Nicole Kidman, Fosse, and Javier Bardem and all these people. And my instinct, because of my fear, is I want to be really cool. Like, I want to just look like I got, you know, I'm not affected. And I was finding myself uncomfortable. Sometimes I'm uncomfortable in those situations. Then I went to the bathroom and I'm like, what? You're awesome. Just be yourself. Stop worrying about it. You're not trying to get anything from these people. Just, and then I could just sort of relax into it, but just acknowledging that I was having anxiety is what relieved it.
Mm. I was listening to a podcast this morning with Lewis Howes and Amy Cuddy. And Amy was talking about how if you feel a little bit anxious, how if things are going on in your life, you just go into the bathroom and you look in the mirror and you just take a little time out. So that just kind of reminded me the bathroom story. And it wasn't the premiere for Nine Perfect Strangers, was it?
No, it was for, it's the Lucille Ball and Ricky Ricardo being the Ricardos.
Ah, very nice. Very nice indeed. Wow. Okay.
I know. Well, fancy.
Very fancy. I've never been to an official famous movie premiere. Maybe one day, who knows? I know. Yeah. Australia is not really known for big time movie premieres. You got to go to Hollywood where you are right now. So
exactly. Which
I'm even more jealous of anyway. Now that you mention
You'll get here.
One day. So what is the question, Anna? What do you love the most about yourself and your story currently?
That's a great question. What do I love the most? I love that I find humor in almost everything. And I never really realized I was like that. It's interesting because I've been reflecting, I haven't articulated this, it's just a thought I've had, but I've been thinking about it. You know, I'm really for the first time in my life in a place, not only do I love myself, but I have love. I live with my boyfriend and it's healthy. And I've been thinking about people who have loved me in the past, who I have hurt. I was thinking about my old writing partner and an ex-boyfriend and how they both said something similar to me, which is basically like, you have such a unique perspective. You find the humor in everything. And I didn't really take it in at the time, but I do now. And it's like, that's so awesome. I'm funny. And more than that, I'm kind of joyful. I want to have fun. And I see that I'm a very entertaining person. And so I think that's what I love the most about it. You know, Party Girl was a book that I wanted to write because I got sober. I realized that life was, sobriety was nothing like I expected it to be. And I thought, well, if I can save one person from having to feel the way that I did, that will be wonderful. I want people to know how funny it is. Our meetings are hilarious. And I want people to know that. And so that's why I wrote a novel and not a memoir, because I thought it could be funny. And I think that's a gift to be able to take the tragic and make it funny.
I love people that are able to find the joy in almost anything. They're amazing to hang around. Like, it's infectious. Yeah. So, you know, if you are going to, just be someone that is kind, nice, funny, you are going to attract so many people and going to infect a lot of people with the same kind of thing, I guess. So,
Yes, absolutely.
It's reciprocal, right? It passes down when you do see it. And they can't really complain when someone, is there such a thing as being overly joyed? I don't think so.
I mean, there are people who can be annoying with it because it feels disingenuous perhaps, but I know I like being around people like that.
Yeah, when it's authentic joy, right? I think that's a true version of it. So did you ever think that you would be where you are today? Did you ever think that you would write Party Girl, that you'd be, you know, we're launching other people's books, going on these TV shows, I mean, these shows on TV and having Party Girl launched into a TV show?
Movie.
There you go.
You know, I don't really know, because I was never somebody who thought about the future. I never had this is what I want to be when I grow up. I remember it was the last week, you know, the last semester of college when I realized everyone else had plans and I didn't know what I was going to go do. So at the same time, you know, it doesn't surprise me really. I really think that I am, while riddled with fear, as we discussed, not afraid to just claim stuff and just go, yeah, this is me. I help a lot of writers who struggle from imposter syndrome and who think like, who am I to write a book? And who am I to? And I do have way more imposter syndrome about my business, because I can't believe people pay my company, that's me, large sums of money. I can't believe it. And I have a lot of fear around asking for it. I hate being the salesperson because it's so hard for me to say these numbers. And yet what we provide is worth way more. These clients go on and they never make their money from book sales, to be clear, but they make hundreds of thousands of dollars off the businesses that they can build on top of these books. So I'm not offering them that's some kind of a scam, but still that is where my imposter syndrome kicks in.
How have you been able to remove your imposter syndrome? Has it been challenging for you?
It is challenging, and I, you know, there's no solution except walking through it. There's, you know, Pema Chodron is this monk who writes these incredible books. And she talks a lot about how to deal with discomfort, you have to lean into it. You have to go, oh my God, this makes me feel so uncomfortable. Let me feel it, because it's the resistance that causes the pain. It's the resistance that makes it last. So if you just go, I'm scared, you know, and it's funny, I'll tell you, this is very meta. For a long time, I thought I didn't like doing podcast interviews because I would just feel this dread and go, you know, I don't, and people would ask me to do them. And I just go, you know, I really don't like doing them. And then I was like, oh, you're just scared. You don't want to admit you're scared because you've been on CNN Live. So why should you be scared of a podcast interview? But if I just can go, oh, you're just anxious, like it's okay. That's how I deal with it.
Mm. Taking a step into the uncomfortable will eventually be comfortable later on.
Exactly.
I believe that.
My friend Jeff Kober says, you know, life is just about getting comfortable with discomfort.
Yeah, very true. I totally agree with that one. What do you think, you've helped a lot of authors, you know, launch books into the world. And for myself, being a, it's actually funny, this morning I found out that my first book will be launched into the world next year, 27th of September, which is like nerve-wracking. next experience entirely for me. And I kind of relate to the imposter syndrome a little bit there, because I'm thinking, well, is my book going to be good enough? I want it to be good. I want it to sell. I want all that stuff to happen. Then it's like, I've been told all these crazy, I've been rejected by 40 publishers, 40 something agents. And the whole process was like, okay, does that mean that I'm a bad writer? Does that mean my book isn't going to sell if these professionals don't want to take it on? Or what does it mean? So I guess I'm curious, what in your opinion makes a great author and that book to be great at the same time?
First of all, J.K. Rowling was rejected more than you before Harry Potter. So there are so many examples of that. So first of all, what's your book called?
It's called The Path of an Eagle, How to Overcome and Lead After Being Knocked Down.
I love it. Did you know September is recovery month? So that's a very good time peg.
Ah, well, the book actually does talk about a lot to do with addiction. So there you go.
So yes. And so when you are pitching media and all of those things, which you should, you make sure that that can just be a great news peg. And here's the thing about what's a good book. It's all so subjective. I don't read Harry Potter. I don't love Glennon Doyle. Everybody I know thinks Glennon Doyle is just the apex of brilliance. So what do I know? I like reading Martin Amis over and over again. So it's all about personal taste. I think we can all know what's bad quality. To me, bad quality is obviously if it's riddled with errors, but inauthentic and cliched. And we use cliches because we aren't being honest or we don't want to be specific. But the best writers are simply the people who write the most. You can have an intrinsic talent for it, but if you're not practicing, then you're not going to be good. And that's what I say to people, because a lot of people come to us with finished books and they say, everybody told me I should write a book and everybody tells me I'm a great writer. And so I just sort of say, well, okay, do you write every day, all day, and have you for years? Because you're not going to write as well as someone who does do that. And the reason our business works is that people understand that. They understand that they are, these entrepreneurs, for the most part, are terribly successful in one field. And they get that their talent is not in writing and that a writer is going to do it better. And that a ghostwriter is really just taking their brilliance and crafting it onto the page. So in terms of what makes a book successful, to go back to the success question, it's how do you define success? To me, it's not selling a million copies. To me, it's changing people's opinions and lives and making a difference and leaving a legacy and all of those things. Because if we're going to define it based on how many people buy it, like only Glennon Doyle's successful. The rest of us are dismal failures. And J.K. Rowling.
That's a good point, actually. I was speaking to a friend of mine about this the other day, and she mentioned just surrender, like surrender all the fears, surrender all the, I guess you could call it imposter syndromes, those feelings of it, and just let go and allow God to take it where he wants to take it. And I think me being a perfectionist was like, no, I don't want to. Why would I want to do that? I'm giving up the control and I don't like giving up the control. So that was like a massive rebuke for me. And I think it will be a continual rebuke as I'm moving forward to just let go and allow it to be what it is and be comfortable with that. And it's good to know that I didn't reject as much as J.K. Rowling.
You did not. I mean, that's 1,000% it though. Cause it's like, would you rather, jump on a car and try to move it while it's driving? Or would you rather, jump in a car and have it go? and let the driver drive, because that's really the difference. I've had miserable book launches and I've had joyous book launches. Yeah. And the New York Times bestseller was the most miserable. So it's not about the number of copies sold. It's about appreciating, you know, Party Girl, we just relaunched it in September and, you know, a lot went wrong. I had a team member who screwed up and she's no longer a team member. And the reviews didn't show. And it was just kind of one thing after another. And I'm still embracing the joy from it because I get to go, okay, well, that didn't work. So that's good information. So what can I do now? Last week, 2 weeks ago, I met this street artist who has the rights to paint whatever he wants on these boxes around LA. And we went out there and he painted the Party Girl cover on a street corner that I pass all the time. It's one of the most iconic street corners in Los Angeles. And it's like, if I had been focused on, well, everything went wrong with the launch, I couldn't have met this person and come to this great partnership. So it is really about looking for what's there, because everything will go wrong. I promise you, it will not be what you expect it to be. And I don't think any of us would write a book if we didn't kind of go, well, you know what? I may be a genius. This may change the world. And then you know you're a writer when then you think, I can't believe I had the audacity to put this on paper. I'm a total idiot. Like, that's what the journey is. It's vacillating between those two.
Can I tell you a secret?
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I naively thought when I first started writing the book 3 years ago that somehow the first draft would one day become a New York Times bestselling book. I was adamant that it was going to become a New York Times bestselling book. And then when I finished it, I'm like, this is crap. What is this? I had no idea what it was.
that's what it is. That's how you know you're a writer. And I've done it. I don't do it anymore. But I think on my first 4 or 5 books, I was like, I'm a genius. No, I'm horrible. Now I'm just like, I am who I am. I'm neither a genius nor horrible. And it's entertaining if nothing else.
I just love it. I love the whole process of being able to write a book. I mean, yes, it's great to get it out there into the world, but even the whole formation of a book, I think that for me as a creative person is joyous in of itself. Even if I do get those sometimes creative like little blocks here and there, and I'm like, okay, well, I'll just come back to it later on. And I've gotten so much great advice from many different authors, even watching your stuff as well, Anna. It's been great to just take it all on board and take it with my stride, I guess you could say. That's always been helpful. But the second last question that I have for you, Anna, because I just noticed the time, I really enjoy this conversation, is what does it mean to be creative for you?
What it means is, I think, accessing, I mean, not, you know, I guess using God a little bit to access, to make things up. And that can be business. I find marketing super creative. I find business as creative, if not more than writing, because I'm making stuff up. I'm trying things out. I got into writing because I'm obsessed with words and I'm obsessed with why people do the things that they do. And that's what you get in business too. So, you know, it's work that makes you feel alive and is yours.
Mm. I got into writing because I love stories. So yeah. Stories are for me, like, for example, you know, how we're talking about Glennon Doyle. Yeah. To be honest, I'll tell you another secret. I haven't read any of her books. So
read a little bit.
I haven't read them. I got nothing against her at all. Like, love her talks, all that sort of stuff. But for me, it's these kinds of books. You know,
I don't know who that is.
It's. I think it's only Australian based at the moment, but it's kind of like The Keeper of Miracles is Holocaust survivors and real stories that have actually happened in the world and how they've been able to learn amazing things. There's another book that I read that's similar to this one called The Happiest Man on Earth. And Eddie Jaku, he survived Auschwitz and he got to, I think, 101 years old. it's an amazing story. So it's like that for me, in a sense, like I love words, I love stories, I love people, I love true stories even more. And it just helps like transform my understanding of the world, if that makes sense, so much more.
Yeah. I mean, and what about Viktor Frankl?
That too. Yeah. I have that book somewhere there. Yeah. I love his book too.
It's amazing. So let me just ask you. So is it an Australian publisher that's putting your book out?
No, it's actually a US-based publisher. It's Post Hill Press. They're associated with Simon & Schuster, which is one of the top five publishing houses. So they distribute all over the world though, which is pretty cool.
That's amazing.
It's a long story how it all happened, but short end of the stick, I reached out to an editor on a whim, pretty much the same thing as I did with you, and didn't expect them to say yes, let alone even respond to me. And the editor got back to me, said she would read all of the material that I sent over. Anyway, she organized a time to speak with me over Zoom. And then I didn't expect her to say that we want to publish a book over Zoom. And I was like a little taken aback by it, allow it to sink in. But that's a short version of the story. Yeah.
I love it. I can't wait to buy a copy.
Oh, you're too kind.
So you have your Hollywood premiere where you can see, you know, how not that great it is. No, it is great here, but you can have your Hollywood experience.
You're absolutely amazing. Where do you want people to find you, Anna, connect with you, learn more about you, buy the copy of the revised version of Party Girl or relaunching version? Where do you want people to go and get it?
The best place is just to go to partygirlrelaunch.com. Yeah. Right?
That's easy.
And you know, and I have all sorts of giveaways that, you know, that 7 days of writing tips, what it takes to be a best-selling author. And so people can just go to launchpaddownload.com to get whatever the latest one is when they hear this. So, and then I'm on Instagram. That's probably the social media, you know, one that I'm the most active on, at Anna B. David.
I love all her content, by the way. It's pretty cool. That's why I always get something out of it anyway. So thank you for being your authentic self. My final question for you, this is my all-time favorite question I ask everyone at the end of all my conversations. It's a hypothetical one, but I want you to imagine with me for a moment that you've been able to reach the age of 100. All your friends and your family have decided to put together a film for you of everything you've ever said and everything you've ever done. Don't ask me how in the world they got it all. We'll call it magic for the sake of argument. But they've been able to get it and show it to you on your 100th birthday. What do you want that film to say and to show about your life?
Wow. That I grew, that I was always focused on improving, not emotionally, and that I loved, and that I made people laugh.
It's a perfect send-off message. Anna David, thank you so much for your time today, your story, your wisdom, your advice, everything that you're doing in the world. Thank you so much for joining me today on this Storybox podcast.
So much. You are such a delight.
I really don't like this part because it means that sadly we have come to an end of yet another story. I just want to say thank you to all of you for tuning in and listening to our guest today. It is my prayer that you would have felt inspired, motivated, challenged in some way, and that you would have learned something new as well. If you would like to hear more amazing stories like this one, you can do so now by searching up the Storybox on all podcast platforms. It is that easy. And if you did get something from today's guest, please do share it around with your friend or family member who you feel could benefit from hearing today's story. And before you go, I greatly appreciate it if you could spend 30 seconds leaving a rating review over on Apple Podcasts. It goes a long way to reaching more people and building this community of the Storybox. Let's start changing lives through powerful stories like this one you heard today. Your support is always greatly appreciated. Until next time, when we dive back into the story box, I'm Jay Phantom. And don't forget, your story is worth more than you know. I'll catch you then.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.